Emma and Tom Talk Teaching, a podcast about all things education, presented by Emma O'Duher and Tom Breeze. Episode 17, Teacher Recruitment with Dr. Emily McLeod.
Welcome back, everyone, to another episode of Emma and Tom Talk Teaching. And we have another special guest for you coming to us down the line. Now, this special guest has actually featured on the podcast. Tom, you read out a 13-tweet stream of hers in our December 23 Christmas episode. So tell us about her.
Yes, this is the culmination of a rather beautiful story, isn't it? Because I read out the tweet stream by Dr. Emily McLeod about teacher recruitment and getting people into the profession. And I mentioned then that I sort of had this germ of an idea about getting Emily on the podcast and that I had started off by following her and then I'd noted that she'd followed me back. Well, listeners, I then got a very nice message from Emily after our episode came out, who actually she sat through the whole episode. So that's worth about 20 points to start with, and has now joined us on the line to talk in more detail about her research into why people become teachers. So, Dr. Emily, welcome.
Thank you. It's so great to be here. Thank you both. I'm pleased that I've already got points. Hopefully I can get some more today.
Yeah, you'll have loads of points by the end. Do you want to tell us a little bit about who you are and what you've done and how you ended up doing a doctorate in this?
Yeah. Well, my first degree was in law and French, partly actually because I really enjoyed French at school, but I wasn't that sure about becoming a teacher. So I thought if I mixed it with law, it would give me some more options. But I did become a French teacher straight after university. And I really enjoyed that. But actually, I did a master's in education research while I was teaching. And that I just really loved. I found it absolutely fascinating. And it was really useful to kind of understand some of those inequalities that I was seeing in the classroom, understand what was happening like behind the scenes as well as within my classroom. So then because I did the master's, when I was moving area, I thought, oh, I've got to look for a new job anywhere. I wonder if you can get a job in education research. And here I am, basically. So yeah, I wasn't quite sure what education research was at the time, but I ended up joining the Aspires project team, which was at King's College London at the time. Aspires is a really longitudinal, like really large scale national study, which I'll probably talk to you a bit more about later, but it's tracked young people's career aspirations over now 13 years. So it's a really fascinating study. And yes, so I worked on that first as a project administrator and project officer, collecting some of the data and doing some of the data analysis. And I found that team and the data so interesting that I ended up doing a PhD in it. So yeah, as we'll talk more, it was all about teacher recruitment and using some of that data to understand why people first aspire to become teachers. And then more importantly, do they then realise those aspirations or do they drop them and why?
And I think you've given us a hint there, but what was the sort of gap in the literature that you felt wasn't being addressed? And how did you feel was the best way to go about addressing that gap?
Yeah, good question. I was in the unusual position, perhaps as a PhD student, that I already knew some of the secondary data. I knew it fairly well. I'd collected some of it that I wanted to use in my PhD. So rather than being completely driven by the question, I was also driven by wanting to use this amazing data set that I had access to from the Aspires project. And knowing that and what I had available to me, I did a bit of research and found out that, as we know, and as you've mentioned, teacher recruitment and teacher supply are massive issues. We desperately need more teachers, and it's been an ongoing issue for over a decade now. And while there's been a lot of research in that area, in terms of teacher recruitment, the vast majority of research has actually sampled and mostly surveyed people already teaching. So be that people who are already working as teachers in schools or people who are about to enter the profession of teaching. So, for example, teacher education students and ITE students. So while that is really useful in terms of research into what motivates existing teachers, it does leave a gap in the research. And what I call that is, like, it's one-sided, but it's also one-off. So one-sided, it's great. it tells us the story of people who go into teaching, but it doesn't tell us the story of people who don't go into teaching and why that is. But it's also one-off because it's quite retrospective. It's from one point in time, people telling us once they're in the profession or about to join the profession, what made them join the profession, rather than understanding that decision-making process as it happens. And that's where that longitudinal data comes in. So I was able to track people over a period of 13 years to understand what made them interested in teaching and then how they made that choice of whether or not to become a teacher over time.
And of course, like this is, it's so huge, really, this area, and it leaves everyone all the way up to government scratching their heads about how they can address this problem. But curious to find out in the first instance, before we get on to sort of, you know, what you found, something I noticed in your abstract was that you decided to apply quite an interesting theoretical framework to your analysis of the data. So we know that you had access to this data. We know which part of that journey you were trying to target. But I'm curious to know what identities in practice as a theoretical framework entails and why you chose to go with that.
Oh yeah, that's a juicy question to get started in. So yeah, my research was mixed methods. So I had some survey data and some interview data, but I definitely refer to the research as qualitatively led because that longitudinal in-depth qualitative data with interviews with young people and their parents, and they spanned such a long period of time, that was where I really wanted to spend the most time analysing. So I use this, as you say, identities and practice lens. So it's from a woman called Dorothy Holland in the US, who wrote a great book back in the late 1990s. And I think the key concept that listeners might be interested in that I use from that is called figured worlds. And it was a way for me to try to make sense of how young people felt in relation to teaching. So the idea being that we're all members of multiple figured worlds or realms all at once. So for example, we might be the member of the figured world of teacher education, or if we play on a football team, we might be the member of the figured world of that football team. And all these worlds kind of cross over and things like that. We can be members simultaneously, or we can be the outskirts of a figured world. But the idea is that I was trying to track young people's trajectories into and around the figured world of teaching, and using their like identity work, what did they do themselves to try to progress that trajectory, or were the things that kind of deterred them or barred that trajectory into teaching? So yeah, Holland and colleagues refer to our like social identities, for example, our gender and our ethnicity and our social class might make it more difficult for us to become members of certain figured worlds. And that was where my kind of like sociology background and my experience of working on the Aspires project, which has quite a sociological lens, really like helped me understand how people make those choices to teach or not. Yeah, so that's it in a nutshell. Yeah, I hope that made sense.
We often hear this sort of idea that teachers are born, not made, you know, or sometimes people report it themselves. You know, we're often interviewing people for the PGCE over here, and they report that they've always wanted to be a teacher ever since they were tiny. Mm. And, you know, some people, even in teaching, believe that you just got it or you haven't. And there seems to be some quite interesting material that's come out of your analysis about that particular kind of old chestnut about teaching. So what have you got to tell us about whether teachers are born or made?
Yeah, that's such a great point, Tom. That is, I think, perhaps the thing that was most striking to me from my research. You're absolutely right. I think most people have heard some reference to teaching being a vocation or being born to teach, or even just slightly like lower down the scale, some people being more well suited to teaching. And I think I hadn't really questioned that view before. It's something that we see and hear a lot, though there's some academics in the US, someone called Madero wrote a great book on this recently. It's quite, if you think about it, quite a traditional, almost religious notion when you think about it in more detail. But one of my findings that I kind of really interrogated once it started coming up was that the young people in my study who became teachers, retrospectively, very much bought into this idea. They definitely refer to themselves as having always, they were always meant to teach. They were actually always going to become a teacher. And fine on one hand. And in fact, that really made sense to me because I had this longitudinal data that tracked them from primary school all the way through their secondary education, through further and higher education, and now they were pursuing teaching. They'd actually had quite messy trajectories into teaching. They'd gone back and forth. So I think we all do this. They had made sense of their trajectory by saying, I've always wanted to teach. I actually always was going to be a teacher. So, for example, one of my participants, Carol, spoke about how once she'd made the decision to teach, she actually told me for the first time about how she'd taught her grandmother English when she was little, and it's not something that she'd mentioned before, but she kind of made sense of, oh, now I'm a teacher, and she used that to make sense of her past experiences. But the joys of longitudinal data, in fact, enabled me to see that these young people, in fact, hadn't always been destined to teach. I had, like, the people who became teachers, as I mentioned, it was messy. They had teaching aspirations at some points, but they didn't at other points. And some of them had definitely turned away from or against teaching before then turning back towards it. And I think that was particularly striking when in teacher education, they were all telling me, oh yeah, I was always going to teach. It was always teaching for me. And yeah, I think there's a couple of things there. I think, firstly, I really think that this is an important finding because, as I mentioned, a lot of the research in this area already is retrospective. So it relies on people who are in teaching telling us retrospectively why they joined teaching. And if those people are saying, oh, I was always going to teach, but actually they weren't, then we need to just question some of that data and just like view it with a more critical eye than perhaps we have been previously. And the other thing that I think is particularly important to raise is that the people who became teachers and then told me that they were probably always going to teach, it was destined, they were all white women. And as we know, so this research happened in England, but I know it's very much the same in Wales. The vast majority of teachers are white women, and there are calls to try to understand how we can diversify that workforce a little bit more. And I started to question, well, why are these people all white women, and why are they all saying that they were destined to teach? And I think that kind of raises a lot of questions. Is it that our wider societal view of teachers, you know, we know that teachers are caring and loving, and that it's very feminine, for example. And is it only white women who think that they are born to teach or destined to teach? So I think that it raises a lot of questions about, fine if they think they're born to teach, but hang on, what does that mean for people who don't think they're born to teach, and who are those people? So yeah, I think it raises a lot of potentially useful questions that could then go on to inform recruitment. So yeah, I think it's a bit of a troubling one. It's something that I would urge people to start to question a little bit more, that notion of being born to teach.
And in what ways did your findings, your research, call into question that sort of perspective of, you know, of it being something that you're born to do? For those in particular who did not go into teaching, did you find any sort of differentiation between, you know, first of all, how ethnically diverse was your participant population? Were you able to see those distinctive differences when looking at it, you know, cutting the data in that way?
I think it's maybe in terms of the diversity and representation of the sample. So in the quantitative analyses I did, because I was able to use data from this Aspires project, which has tracked young people's career aspirations over 13 years, I was actually able to look at survey responses from 60,000 young people. And that has tracked this cohort of young people from age 10, 11, so their last year of primary school, up to the age of 20 to 21. So if they're doing a degree, it's like towards the end of that degree for most people. So we surveyed that cohort on the Aspires project about every 2 years. And we said, like, what are you interested in? What would you like to be when you're older? What are you pursuing and why? And just as an aside, the Aspires Project had has a focus on understanding why people do and do not want to aspire to STEM or science, in particular careers. So that enabled me to see who aspires to teaching at different age groups and why. And strikingly, this was a huge surprise to me when I first did the analyses. Actually, a third of young people at each of those ages, so there were six ages as they grew up where we surveyed them, a third of young people at each of those ages reported that they were open to teaching, which is fascinating because it indicates that quite a lot of people are interested in teaching or open to teaching, but hang on, not a third of young people are actually pursuing teaching. So what's going on there? But back to your question, I definitely found that when I looked at that data like more critically and tried to understand who's saying that they're open to teaching, it was by far much more likely for those who identified as white and those who identified as women to be more likely to agree that they were interested in becoming a teacher. Yeah, so I think that it again hints at what is it that we as a society understand as being a teacher, how are teachers represented, and also how are teachers recognised. So I thought of these young people as potential future teachers because they were kind of interested in teaching at some point. They reported that they've perhaps wanted to become a teacher when they're older, even if it was just once. But if we're considering these young people as potential future teachers, are, for example, their parents considering them as potential future teachers? And if those young people do not identify as white young women, are they less likely to be identified as a potential teacher? And it just makes you think, who is it that's being encouraged or recognised as teachers? Because definitely those white young women were much more likely to express that aspiration.
Starting to reflect now on the attitudes that pervade this profession that I'm part of, you know, and this point you're making that in order to get into it, you have to rationalize it that you've given yourself over fully to the teaching cult, if you like. And I'm thinking about the times when Emma and I interview people who are looking to come into the profession, and perhaps they make some comment about it being some form of a backup plan, you know, or something hasn't worked out, or they always had it down as their sort of plan B. And reflecting, I think perhaps I'm guilty of bristling a little bit when somebody says that, well, you know, I don't want you here and you're doing your plan B or whatever. But actually, I guess we can't afford to be like that because of the numbers coming through. And also, actually, now the way you put it, it's actually a little bit worrying that we sort of demand this even retrospective full giving over of yourself to the cult. You mentioned about people who see it as a backup plan. I mean, what happens to those people, assuming that they don't give themselves fully over to, yes, I'm definitely now called to be a teacher and always have been in this rewriting of history? What happens to the backup plan people? Is it that people like me don't look at them very, very sort of nicely, or do they just drift away?
Yeah, I think that was such an interesting finding. I think this backup plan idea, as I mentioned, it was kind of something in my own background and career trajectory, but it wasn't something that I'd expected to find in the data. I'd kind of just assumed people would be either teaching or very against teaching. But the vast majority of the young people, whether it was in the surveys or the interviews, they were somewhat open to it. And it was a backup plan, but not their first choice. And as I mentioned, I think that this is, on one hand, very promising because it means that, like referring back to those awful teacher shortages that we face, perhaps actually there's this massive pool of young people who are somewhat open to teaching that might be persuaded at some point to pursue the profession. And yeah, I completely understand why perhaps it would be, or it feels more preferable for people to have it as a first choice. But I we need more teachers, and why not? I don't think just because it's someone's backup plan doesn't mean that they're going to be a bad teacher. And actually, I think when we all reflect on our own past career experiences, are any of us on our first choice or our plan A from when we were in our early 20s? I think that's quite a rare thing, to be honest. But yeah, that backup plan thing, I had 13 young people in my qualitative sample who I really looked at in depth. So that was in total 146 interviews. So loads of rich data about them and their family lives and their aspirations and trajectories over time from primary school and throughout their education. And of those 13, 10 of them had actually decided against teaching by the time that they're in their early 20s. But for all of them, apart from two, teaching was still a backup. So I counted them as not pursuing teaching because they weren't, but it was still their backup. And it wasn't that the door had completely closed. And I think that this is something that we, like in teacher education and policymakers, could be more aware of and could perhaps do more to attract those people. When someone's turned against teaching, it's not forever, I think is the main point there. We don't need to like do loads to persuade people, you know, come over, this is what teaching's like. I think they know and they like the idea of it. There are some other systemic issues that are perhaps putting them off or a pull from somewhere else. But yeah, it's much more common as a backup plan than I expected, absolutely.
Two things that come through quite strongly in your study are the relationship and the influence of status of teaching and the safety of teaching and how participants' sort of views of those two things change and how they their views of those two things sort of play into their decision making about whether to go into or not go into teaching. So tell us what you found that was sort of is going to be influential to the recommendations around status and safety.
So I think we work in education and particularly around teaching, we hear the word status a lot, right? I think a lot of people refer to teaching sometimes as a low status profession in comparison to other careers. But actually, what I wanted to do was understand why all of my sample first wanted to teach and then why did some go on to teach and why didn't some go on to teach? And when I looked at the data and started coding it and then took kind of a step back, I realized that these two themes were really strong throughout. And yeah, what I found was there was something common amongst all of them when they aspired to teach. And then those things continued for those people who went on to teach, but they were lost for those people who decided not to teach. And yeah, those things were what I call status and safety, but how I'd term them is I refer to status as teaching being like constructed as a profession which benefits others rather than this thing that refers to it in relation to other careers. It's a good profession and it benefits others. And the safety element is teaching being seen or perceived as a career which is secure and accessible. And I think that probably makes sense to a lot of listeners. We know that teaching is secure, having just been through the pandemic. We know that it's something that is seen as more secure than other roles. But yeah, as you mentioned, what was particularly noticeable is that these notions of status and safety were what I call relative and transitory. So by relative, I mean that they depended on each individual. What was high in status for one person was not high in status for another. And I think that that's where I start to question this like label that we sometimes put on teaching. Oh, it's high status, it's low status. It's neither. It depends. And what it depends on was young people's age, the stage of their career or education they were in, but also their gender, their ethnicity, what was happening in their family lives, but also what's happening in the wider world, like for example the pandemic. And same with this idea of safety. What was safe for one young person was not necessarily safe for them a few years later, and it wasn't necessarily safe for another person. So for example, we hear a lot in the media about teaching not being as well paid as other careers, but one of my sample, for example, both of her parents had always worked in retail, and she spoke a lot about wanting to teach because it was so well paid. She would be able to earn way more money than her parents had ever earned. And I think that those of us working in universities, like we've come from a like different background often, and it's easy to forget that our view or one person's view isn't the same as someone else's. So yeah, this status and safety were very key to whether or not and why a young person first wanted to teach and then became a teacher. But in terms of how we then like use that and utilize it to turn into recommendations, what's key there is that it's different for everyone. Yeah.
Just kind of following up on this question of people's perceptions, particularly young people's perceptions. And, and you know, I know a doctorate is quite a narrow piece of work. So if I do my annoying habit of asking a question that falls outside your field of work, just slap it away. But this is what interests me, because you're talking about perceptions there. One of the really fun things about teaching and perceptions of teaching is that everybody's been to school and therefore everybody kind of thinks they know what teaching is. And obviously a lot of the young people are that you were speaking to were probably quite close proximity to quite a lot of teachers quite a lot of the time. Did you get a sense of how accurate their perceptions of teaching were? Because you sort of assume that they know what it is because they're experiencing it all the time. And I suppose the logical sort of follow-up question to that is, to what extent are we dropping the ball by assuming that kids know what being a teacher is just because they've been taught by one?
Yeah, this is really important, I think. I think to come to your second question first, I think we in the profession do a lot of assuming that young people understand what a teacher does, and they don't. They only see that kind of front stage work of a teacher, and not even that much of it, you know? If you only see like one class, and each class is different, as we know, as teachers. So I think there are a lot of assumptions going on, both on our side as teachers, but also on the side of the young people assuming what makes up a teacher's working day, for example. I think it's a bit of a mix, I think, because I'm aware that a lot of the reasons, to bring in retention briefly, a lot of the reasons why people want to leave the profession are often to do with what is perhaps that backstage work and the workload and the bureaucracy of the profession. And that's the thing that young people can't always see. So I don't think that the answer is like, you know, shadowing teachers all the time, for example. But I think that it's a very simplified view of what a teacher is, and not always a positive one. You know, if you happen to be in a disruptive class, but the next class that teacher has might not be so disruptive, for example. I think it changes hour by hour, doesn't it, the role of teaching, and young people don't always get a sense of that.
I was interested about this idea of status and perceptions of whether teachers are professionals who use their gifts to benefit others. And going back to Tom's point about how, you know, we often get these applicants that come in sort of nobly saying that, you know, they really care about working with young people, they want to be, you know, that emotionally available adult. They don't necessarily use those words, but they're talking about, you know, that sort of almost, I shouldn't use the word maternal because it plays into this image of white British women.
It's difficult though, isn't it?
It is. But I wonder if you got a sense of or if you've got a view on how we sort of put across this idea that to become a teacher, it's about this sort of benevolent doing of good, as opposed to the skill and the craft of, you know, can you come into teaching, and do we put enough emphasis on the sort of skill of coming into teaching that doesn't foreground in your first answer of why you want to be a teacher as being because I really love kids and I really want to work with them. You know, can it be something else, and should we be putting emphasis on something else?
Absolutely. So I think you've hit the nail on the head. One of my recommendations is for us to really try to portray teacher education as learning a skilled profession through professional education. And I think that is what's sometimes lacking. To compare it to doing a degree in medicine, I think that people understand that doctors spend a lot of time learning their craft and that they're not born knowing, you know, how to care for people. And there's something about ITE or initial teacher education that is little understood, I think, by those who haven't been a part of it. And I think that emphasizing that teaching is a skilled profession that you don't need to know that's the job of the teacher education, that through specialised education, you can learn that craft. That is what needs to be emphasised more. And I think partly playing into that, and perhaps also answering your last point in a bit more detail, Tom, is that actually, I don't know if it's the same in Wales, but at the time of writing last year in England, there were 7 different routes into teaching, 7 different ways to gain qualified teacher status. And that was quite hard for me to understand while I was doing my research, let alone someone who might want to go into teaching. It's a very complex landscape. So I think it's not only difficult to understand which routes there are into teaching, but which one's right for you, but also understanding its professional education. I think that is something that isn't emphasised enough. Yeah.
So moving on to this sort of sense of what can we do, I'm really taken by the chunk of your table of contents that talks about teacher breakers, because, you know, to go back to the point that you made earlier on, there's a massive chunk of young people who are, you know, reasonably up for being a teacher. And as you rightly say, an enormous number of them seem to have fallen by the wayside by the time it's time to fill in a form to come and, you know, learn to be one. So I suppose the first stage is to know, well, what sort of things are causing people to fall by the wayside? What sort of specific traps do we need to look out for? And I suppose, you know, by extension, what can we do to keep as many of those one third on the right side of the fence as we possibly can?
Yeah. Well, the simple answer is it's quite a messy picture, and there's lots of things I think that would, unfortunately, it's not an easy fix. Because as I mentioned, I think that partly some of those people drop off of that trajectory because they're not, for example, recognised as a teacher, perhaps because they don't identify as a white young woman, or they're not seen as maternal. Therefore, when they care for their, you know, younger siblings or something, it's not quite seen as teacher. It's seen as leader, for example. And I think it's worth saying here that we hear a lot about pay here. And I do think that pay is key in terms of perhaps we can attract more people into teaching by increasing salaries. However, in this research, it was with young people at the start of their careers. And while some of them were somewhat aware that they'd read that teachers aren't paid as well as some other careers, actually, like, teachers are not badly paid, I wouldn't say. And they seem to agree, like, any salary, you know, a starting salary is a starting salary. And that wasn't the, you know, nail in the coffin, the final teacher breaker for them. Actually, it was more complex than that. So, for example, one of my sample, we mentioned status and safety earlier. One of them, his pseudonym was Hedgehog.
Great.
For him, they chose their own pseudonyms when they were 10.
Was he a prickly
stuck with
character?
So Hedgehog, actually for him, the safety of teaching was lost, actually, because you had to pay to do a degree. And no one in his family had ever done a degree before. So he kind of questioned, hang on, why do I want to be a teacher? I'd have to pay a lot of money to do, go to university to do that. Why would I waste my money there? We know, perhaps, having working in universities, that there are other ways, like there are funds and ways to support going to university and paying for ITE. But why would he know that? No one's told him that. So trying to make it more, like, increase that awareness of the accessibility. And then the bigger thing is for those people for whom teaching became less high in status. And this really comes back to it not being seen as this skilled profession. So these are, for example, the young people, a lot of them were science undergraduates. And in fact, 3 of the science undergraduates who I looked at in more detail had actually applied to ITE and then dropped out. So they were so close to becoming teachers and then decided not to. And a big part of it was because in science, at least, they were very much encouraged and expected to do a master's degree and then perhaps a PhD themselves, absolutely fine. But in comparison, initial teacher education was not seen on the same level. It was not seen as this professional qualification. It was seen as becoming a teacher. And compared to a master's, which a lot of their undergraduate had been building up to, lecturers had spoke to them, or you're expected to do a master's soon, whether that was implicitly or explicitly. ITE just wasn't seen on that same level. And also, just to add, it wasn't mentioned for a lot of them. A couple of the young people who I spoke to, so for example, one of them was doing a PE degree, so physical education, and that's perhaps not a surprise that she did receive some careers education throughout her degree about, oh, this is how you can become a PE teacher. But the rest of them didn't. They weren't told, oh, you're a potential science teacher. Is anyone interested in becoming a science teacher? We can tell you about the routes into teaching. So some of it is quite simple. We need to increase that careers education for them, but also, but going back to emphasising that teaching is a skilled profession that you can learn through specialised education. You don't need to be born with it.
Now, this is interesting, just to jump in for a sec, because the other day, Emma was talking to us about some work by Professor Rachel Lofthouse about the pedagogy of professional decline. Basically, you know, these multi-academy trusts over in England, you know, and I'm quite pleased to say we don't have those over here in Wales, but multi-academy trusts centralising their curriculum to the point that it becomes scripted and the teacher becomes a deliverer of a script. That doesn't sound to me like that's a great solution, because not only are the teachers themselves going to not be feeling particularly skilled, but actually there's a bunch of pupils in the room are going to be seeing that happen.
Yeah, that's a good point. That's something that I didn't explore explicitly through the thesis, but you're right. And what it made me think of as well is different initial teacher education models look quite different. Like, some of them are school based in England, rather than being based at a university, for example. Some of them have more pedagogy, and some of them, are more like delivering rather than that kind of skilled teaching, as you say. I think my overall point here would be the teacher education market is so complex. As I said, like, there's so many different ways to become a teacher and to teach. Actually, I think it's too complex. It's very hard to understand how you teach and what teaching is, but also how to become a teacher. So I think one of the things needed there is make it a bit simpler. But I agree. I think bringing in the professional model is really important, and like underlining the importance and all that research that people like us do to understand why it is that we teach in that way. I think that really needs to be more widely known to boost teaching to be known as a profession. Yeah.
Time is an important one that I've come to sort of understand from your research, and timing, when we intervene, when we propose the idea of teaching. And you know, do you have anything, any specific recommendations on that? And, you know, how, at what intervals and by whom?
Yes. Yeah, so, well, on one hand, because my research was longitudinal, I would say in an ideal world, we'd be telling young people, hey, did you know you can become a teacher? This is some of the ways that you could do it. This is what it might look like. Do you have questions? And supporting young people while they're still in school. But I appreciate that teaching isn't the only career available to young people. And, you know, logistically, that is difficult. But yes, timing in terms of, so teaching is a graduate profession, and undergraduate is the, for most young people in England becoming, most people in England becoming teachers have an undergraduate degree before they commit to becoming teachers through postgraduate teacher education. I'm not quite sure if it's the same like kind of proportions in Wales, but that means that undergraduate degrees are definitely the place where I would urge practitioners and policymakers to increase careers education around teaching. And as I say, I think it on one hand is relatively simple. We need to introduce the concept of teaching and remind people, hey, you know that career that you did know about when you were in school, as you mentioned earlier, Tom, people know what teachers are, is one route, because you can become a teacher from any degree. There's pretty much no restrictions. So anyone can be a teacher if they have an undergraduate degree. It's just because you've done one subject doesn't restrict you from teaching. But that careers education isn't available. I think the other thing I'd say is that it should be more regular, you know, not just one-off. One of the things that using the longitudinal data made me realise is that even though we retrospectively try to make sense of our trajectories quite neatly, they're actually very messy and complex and multi-directional. And one day we might be thinking about teaching, and then we might see an advert or read a book that makes us think about something else. So I think it's not, first year or second year or third year. I think it's all of them. But I think that it can be quite a simple fix if we just increase that careers education, and preferably for some work experience as well, if that's available in some degree courses too. Yeah.
I was interested to note that of the 13 young people that you interviewed, you also interviewed 17 of their parents. So I'd be keen to know what influence, if any, they had over the young person's trajectory towards becoming a teacher, or being a teacher breaker, as it were.
Yeah, I think that one's perhaps a difficult one to answer, because for the most part, the parental interviews were really useful in just getting a broader picture of the young people's lives, what was happening at home, what exactly it was that their parents did and what that might mean. The conversations around the kitchen table, for example, if there were conversations around the kitchen table for a start. I think that it was quite obvious sometimes when a parent or parents had quite an idea in mind for what their what their child would be when they were older. And I'm sad to say that it wasn't ever teacher. So one of my sample, called Joanne, she did a science undergraduate degree, went on to do science postgraduate degrees. And very early on, when she was like 10, her father said, "I can see Joanne becoming a I can see Joanne becoming a lawyer." But they were very keen for her to do science, and she ended up doing science. And Joanne all this time was like, "I quite like the idea of teaching. I like teaching my peers at school." She did quite a lot of work experience during her sixth form and when she was at university herself in the local school. And then she ended up doing this science degree. Didn't want to pursue science. She had as some listeners might be aware, had some issues with the systemic problems that we have in academia in terms of, chasing funding all the time, things like that. So she didn't really want to work in scientific research as she had anticipated alongside teaching. And then she ended up becoming a lawyer, as had been predicted by her parents at age 10, which I found really fascinating. So I think that what was striking about the parental data was that actually it was shocking sometimes how much influence a parent has, a bit scary sometimes actually. And they often didn't think too highly of their child becoming a teacher, sadly. And then it comes back to, we need to underline that teaching is a great profession. It can help people. It's very skilled. You don't need to be born to do it. Yeah.
I suppose one quite topical question I have is that we hear a lot about the pandemic having changed working conditions. People are working a lot more flexibly in their jobs. Sometimes they get to work from home, for example. Their hours have gone a bit more flexible. And teaching kind of doesn't work like that. And you do hear some people saying that part of the reason for the drop-off is people are looking at teaching going, well, I'm not going to be able to work from home, some days a week. It's not a very flexible job. Did you get any sense that young people were put off teaching by the fact that it's quite inflexible in that respect, that you have to be there in the classroom, you have to turn up every day? Or was that not really on their radars?
Great question. I've seen a lot of discussions about this too since the pandemic, and you're absolutely right. I think I've seen some schools try to see how and whether they can implement more flexible working or working from home as a teacher. But because my research was with young people who had yet to start their careers, it actually wasn't something that was mentioned at all. It wasn't something that was important to these young people. I think perhaps because they hadn't had that experience of work. So a bit like the pay thing, any pay was good for them. I think any job was good for them. It wasn't that they really were keen to have a job where they could work from home or that they could work very flexibly. I imagine if I was to redo this research with career changes, people who might go into teaching having done a different career first, I can see why it would make sense that some people might be put off with the potential inflexibility of teaching. So absolutely, I don't think it's something that we need to neglect. However, in terms of young people, that is not going to be a teacher maker for them, I'm afraid. Yeah.
Dr. Emily McLeod, the contribution of knowledge that you have made to this, you know, one of those wicked problems that we have within the teaching profession is huge. And we talk about impact. It was really reassuring to see that, and as Tom brought it to the table in our Christmas episode, that you're really trying to get this out there in a way that is accessible to anyone that's busy and working in the profession and wants to know the headlines of it. So we thank you very much for sort of coming on to our podcast to get it out in this format too. Before we go on to the short slots, what are you working on next? I'm sure there are some papers in the making, in the writing.
Yeah, absolutely. You're so right. While I loved doing the PhD and writing the PhD, though I'm aware that I'm quite lucky to be able to say that, I found it really fascinating. 100,000 words is perhaps not accessible to busy people. So yes, definitely high up on my list is trying to share my recommendations and my findings more broadly through podcasts like this. I wrote an IWE blog just before Christmas, if anyone wants to have a look at that too. But yeah, besides that, definitely some shorter papers are in the making, particularly around this idea that, like, is teaching a vocation, this thing that we're born with, and why are these young people who go into teaching, and particularly white women, so inclined to kind of tell that narrative, and what's the impact of that? So please, yeah, keep an eye out for more papers coming this way. And longer term, I would love for this to become more of an accessible book. So yeah, please keep an eye out for Teacher Makers and Teacher Breakers by Emily McLeod, but perhaps that'll be a few years away yet.
Got the title already, that's good.
Yeah.
Well, we're very grateful because we know that you have done your homework for us. So we're keen to hear, what have you got that our listeners might find interesting?
Yeah, I knew that you would be coming up with this question because I'd listened to a few of your episodes previously. This one is, I'm imagining your listeners, like me, love a podcast because we're all here. and one I've listened to recently is, perhaps you know it already, called John Ronson's Things Fell Apart. It's on the BBC iPlayer app, or BBC Sounds app, I should say. And it's all about the culture wars. And I listened to the first season. And then as I was listening to the first season recently, the second season came out. And whilst it's not about education specifically, in that second season, there are quite a few episodes that mention teachers and interview teachers and talk about how the culture wars, mostly in America though, I should say, really influence young people's lives and the education they're experiencing. So I won't give any spoilers, but it really made me think about the education system more widely, and then how it affects our everyday lives and how everything kind of comes together. Yeah, I found it really fascinating. Things Fell Apart by John Ronson.
Well, coincidence, because we know Emma's a big fan of that one as well. So to save us having this degenerating into a John Ronson fan fest, I'm going to ask you to move swiftly on to our Something to Try.
Yeah, I thought about this one. I'm going to do a slight plug here for, I mentioned I've been a member of the Aspires project for the past about 8 years. And so Aspires is this wider longitudinal study that's looked into young people's aspirations and trajectories, particularly in science. And just in November last year, so quite recently, we published our third report. So that's summarising all of our findings so far from tracking this cohort from age 10 to age 22 now, and whether people go into science and STEM careers. But I'd encourage people to have a look at that most recent report, even if they're not in the field of science or STEM, because actually it's quite a good introduction, I think, to sociology. And in particular, on that project, my colleague, Professor Louise Archer, has termed the phrase science capital, which uses this notion of cultural capital from Pierre Bourdieu, and it's all about the resources and contacts and experiences within science that young people have available to them, and whether and how that influences their interest in science and their experiences of science, and then whether they go on to science. And it's a really good example, I think, of how those, what we end up doing and what we don't end up doing, is not necessarily always just an influence about what we're interested in, but it's also about the social and structural barriers that exist for some people. So yeah, really recommend anyone look out for the Aspires project.
Emily, thank you very much for giving us an insight into what must have been a real sort of, must have felt like a life's work so far, putting that thesis together. So we congratulate you on that, and we wish you all the very best for your future work that you've just described to us. And I'm sure we'll have you back at some point in the future. You can run, but you can't hide.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been great to speak to you.
Well, there we go. That's the end of a lovely Christmas story. We came across Dr. Emily McLeod, and now she's been on the podcast. So thank you, everybody, for listening to that. We, as ever, will be back with two... With? No, we won't. I'm going to say that again. We, as ever, will be back with you in 2 weeks' time. Bye for now. You've been listening to Emma and Tom Talk Teaching, a podcast about all things education presented by Emma O'Duha and Tom Breeze. The special guest this episode was Dr. Emily McLeod, who joined us down the line. Thanks to Emily for taking part. Podcast artwork is by Beth Blandford and the music is by Cameron Stewart. Technical support is by Peter Lamben and the studio manager is Adrian Rapps. We're on X at Talk Teaching Pod if you want to come and tell us what you think. We'll be back in a fortnight with something else interesting. Until then, take care and enjoy teaching.